Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Hey guys, welcome back to Breaking Banks. I am your host, Brett King, and Breaking Banks is the number one global fintech radio show and podcast going out to 177 countries with more than 6.5 million listeners annually. The big news this week, of course, is apart from the fact that I'm on the road down under and recording this show for you, we actually have an awesome interview with two sci-fi authors, major players in the game, and you're going to find that super, super interesting. But before we get to that, the news. Now, you probably saw in the news that our good friend Anthony Thompson, the founder of Atom and the co-founder of Metro, launched a new bank down under in Australia. I was there at the launch with Anthony, and you'll hear more about that later with our interview with him coming up in a few weeks. But they launched a new challenger bank in Australia called 86400. Now, if you're wondering where the name 86400 comes from, it's the number of seconds in a day. So they claim they're going to be a real challenger to the big four. I think from a formula perspective, Anthony Thompson obviously has built two banks quite successful in the last few years, so it'll be good to see him take on the Aussie market. We do see, in terms of the latest news, the EBA, European Banking Association, has come out and warned banks regarding fintech. Now, it's interesting what they've done. It's sort of the Goldilocks theorem. They've said, you shouldn't be too passive. You shouldn't be too proactive. Sort of try and find a middle ground. Doesn't risk the customers, but you must innovate. We're seeing this message more and more come through regulators right now, who are basically saying that if you're not regulating fast enough, or sorry, if you're not innovating fast enough, you know, it's going to be a threat to the structure of the market. And so the ability to innovate rapidly really comes down to deploying capital efficiently, and this is where fintechs have a real advantage. Of course, we are seeing some other news. We're seeing more developments on the blockchain side. We're seeing Bermuda has created a new class of banks to encourage fintech adoption. We see Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, has introduced biometric logins for their users. Oracle's locating a fintech hub in Brussels. There's a lot of good news coming out of the fintech space. In terms of conference and announcements for you guys to check out, you will be aware of a couple of upcoming events that we will definitely be talking about more in the show as over the coming months. The team from Provoke, including JP Nichols, myself, and Jim Morales, we will be in New York for Finovate New York, Finovate Fall, at September 24 to 26. We'll be having a power hour live from the stage doing our Breaking Bank show as a panel on the Finovate conference after the demo days. And don't forget also that Cybo Sydney is coming up, and that is happening in October also. So we'll give you more details about Cybos and InnerTribe and what's going on there. That, of course, is the dates for that is 22nd to 25th of October in Sydney, Australia. All right, now, here's the interview I was able to record earlier this week. With Kevin Anderson and Harry Klur, two absolute legends in the sci-fi space. So this week, I had the opportunity to catch up with two legends in the space. If you're talking about sci-fi, all things futurism, technology, artificial intelligence, etc. I won't even talk about zombie detectives yet, but As you guys know, I really love geeking out with futurists and sci-fi authors. You know, there's a lot to be said for the fact that as you know, people working in the future space trying to predict what's going to happen, that sci-fi has been shown to really inform much of the thinking that we do, particularly in terms of longer term projections on that. So I have two really special guests to introduce you guys to today. The first is Kevin J. Anderson. I guess we'll get to what the J stands for in a moment, but he is a science fiction author. He has over 50 bestsellers. He's written in the Star Wars universe, StarCraft, Titan AE, X-Files. He's collaborated with Brian Herbert on the Dune series. Personally, I really loved his series, The Saga of the Seven Suns. Just basically has written in over 140 books, more than 23 million books in print worldwide, an absolute legend. Joining him is a good friend of his. We're going to talk about how they met as well, Harry Kluwer. He's a scientist, has a PhD in physics and chemistry. He's also, of course, though, heavily involved in the genre. He's worked with our good friend Peter Diamandis, the guys at Singularity University on the X Prize. He's a producer, director, writer, an entrepreneur. He's written for film and television, Earth, The Final Conflict, Star Trek Voyager, the Godzilla series, Dead Zone, et cetera, et cetera. So, Harry and Kevin, an absolute pleasure to have you guys on the show today.
It's a great pleasure to be on your show.
Yeah, and thanks. And after that introduction, I don't know if we have much time left for talking, but...
Well, you guys will just do all this work in the field, so we've got to get over it. I mean, we could have gone on for more, but I'll ask you this first. You guys obviously good friends, good mates. You collaborate on a number of things, but how is it that you came to meet?
Well, Harry and I were just having this big argument about whether it was 1993 or 1995, but that's provable. We just haven't bothered to check it yet. we both met. There was a writers' conference that had a tour of the Kennedy Space Center before a nighttime shuttle launch of the Atlantis. And we, as NASA does, they throw everybody on a bus and drive you around the large site. And Harry and I ended up, we'd never met before. We ended up sitting next to each other on the bus, and we just brainstormed and hit it off right away. In fact, in that bus ride, we were brainstorming a Star Trek episode that we pitched.
So we actually began our collaboration within about 10 minutes of meeting, crafting a couple story pitches for Star Trek Voyager. Became not only great friends, but have collaborated on a range of things, including currently on a variety of Kevin's books, Saga of the Seven Suns, which we're hoping to bring to television sometime in the next 18 months.
It'd be a great series for TV,
Well, just last night, I watched the last episode of The Expanse, and the Seven Suns kind of fits in that space, but mine is more Star Trek, Star Wars-y. It's not confined to the local solar system. We're getting too specific there, I think. But Harry and I have been really good partners because we're not competitors. His interests are all over the place and mine are all over the place. And it's more of a synergy because he's got all these interesting scientific contacts. And in fact, he put me together with Ray Kurzweil. We're publishing Ray's first novel in the next few months, actually. And I met Peter Diamandis because of Harry. And I think my favorite story of Harry is that he also is working with the Ansari X Prize for the SpaceX, the first launch of a spacecraft.
It's a good story. It's an example of where I just won't take no from Kevin.
Well, and I did 10 books a year and I'm traveling all over the place and I've got all kinds of commitments. And Harry calls and says, I'm inviting you to watch the launch of the SpaceX thing down in the Mojave spaceport. And I said, well, Harry, thanks, but I'm kind of busy that weekend. I got these deadlines and, I appreciate it. Thanks. And then he called back and said, I refuse to take your no for an answer. I demand that you come here.
And for extra clarity, so it wasn't SpaceX. It was actually for our first X Prize, the Ansari X Prize. And it was going to be the first launch of a private spaceship. And Kevin, who's the top, in my opinion, top 10 of world-renowned living sci-fi writers, is like, no, I don't have time for that. And I'm like, that's like saying you don't have time to ever see Star Wars, Star Trek, and every other sci-fi movie wrapped up into one.
Yeah. So I went, and I was very, very glad I went.
Yeah, well, it's just so exciting, isn't it, to see the rate of launches that SpaceX is doing right now, and what they've done in terms of rethinking rocket design. You know, Elon's sort of approach to first principles, which, you know, has a lot of similarities. And Harry, you'd probably appreciate this, as much as anyone, being a PhD in physics and chemistry.
But well, be correct. I'm a 2 PhDs.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
He's Dr. Harry.
Yeah, it's not a, I'm Dr. So Elon, by the way, was long before SpaceX, he was on our board for XPRIZE, and it was actually the Anasari XPRIZE which inspired and drove Elon towards SpaceX. And that first prize, which was sponsored by Anusha Anasari, led to one of the biggest prize organizations in the world. I think we've given around $80-90 million away. And that actually segues to the latest project that Kevin and I have worked on, which is Avatar Dreams, which is a book that has 14 stories that take place about 20 years after the Avatar X Prize is won, which is a prize I created in 2016. And we launched on March 12th of this year at South by Southwest with $22 million in sponsorship from All Nippon Airlines, and is designed to bring robotic avatars into everyone's life, which is basically a form of teleportation plus.
So I want to delve into this a little bit, but obviously we've got a couple of key technologies right now which are sort of coalescing into this, you know, personalization of this technology and where AR is going to be important. One is obviously, you know, voice-based technology with the AI sort of, you know, a smart assistant or personal assistant. And then, we've obviously got Facebook and Apple and others working on AR, augmented reality glasses and things like that. So, you know, when you think about where this is going, can you describe to me where you think will be in, say, 15 years, the role that avatars might play in our world?
So, one, again, I would direct people to Amazon's Avatar Dreams because it's such a broad area. But to describe and for clarity for your audience on what we mean by avatars, because the word is so overused. In this case, I'm talking about the ability to move your awareness consciousness into a robotic body. And that's very different than, say, in the Avatar movie, where they're kind of actually just moving the physical consciousness into the body. By awareness consciousness, I mean why you think you're in your body. You think you're in your body because of your senses. You're seeing through it, hearing through it, tasting, touching, and also because you are acting and moving through it. And this all happens in sync, and your brain kind of cheats and syncs it all together. So by using a range of exponential technologies, by using VR so you can see through robot's eyes, by using audio so you can hear and talk through it, by using haptics so you can feel and touch through it, and by using any form of motion capture. So when I move my fingers and move my head, the robot moves its associated fingers and head. You then move your awareness consciousness. And we demonstrated this in 2016 in front of 300 influencers at Visioneering and event, and now we're moving to actually create this. So the XPRIZE will drive teams around the world to develop technology. In the meantime, I've launched a company in January called Beyond Imagination with a series of the world's elite, including Anusha Anasari, Andrew Nico, Dean Kamen, Ray Kurzweil, and a whole host of others. Because this is a big endeavor, but our end goal is a billion avatars in 15 years, enabling people to pretty much go anywhere and do anything.
Well, and that's why we work together to do this Avatar Dreams anthology, because what Harry just described, it's a complicated thing. People think of Like here's just a robot from Lost in Space or Rosie the house cleaner in the Jetsons. And that's not what an avatar is. It's basically a sophisticated robot body, but its brain is empty. You put your own consciousness into it to make it work. And so to help show the potential of this technology, we got 14 science fiction writers, including me and Harry, to write stories that just demonstrated this is what avatar technology could be. And you could, it's like tourism. Remember, tourism, you can go into an avatar and climb Mount Everest while you stay safe at home in Colorado or something. Or you already know things like right now, surgeons do remote surgery where they're in one city using connected robotic arms to a patient who's somewhere else. And this is great for like war zones or third world countries where you can have an avatar going in and performing delicate operations where a surgeon might not be able to go. And the Avatar Dreams is just one story after another. And we just threw the concept out and everybody came up with the most amazing surprise stories about, oh, I didn't even think about that, or I never considered it. And that's what science fiction writers do, and that's what I do, is that we just make goofy stuff up and let other people do the work to make it really happen.
Yeah, and in fact, this is a full circle. So, and to describe again for your audience what you could do, it's, well, what do you do with your own body? Not only can you be able to do this anywhere instantly, but you'll be enhanced. So for instance, while Da Vinci is used for remote surgeries, that's the least interesting thing to do with an avatar medically. There are 1.5 billion people on Earth right now that, according to the UN, will never see a medical professional. But with this technology, I can distribute doctors anywhere into an avatar body without them having to leave the cities that they currently reside in. That same avatar that's a doctor in the morning can be a teacher in the afternoon, can be an agricultural specialist a few hours later, can be you and I who've stopped by to see what's going on. The point is it's one body, 8 billion users have the ability to get into it, hopefully not all at once because it's going to be hard to move about. But the point being is yeah. So and there's applications there, but quite literally, one of the applications we're going to come out with is to provide home care to everybody. But at the same time, if you want to go shopping in Paris, Moscow, Japan, Los Angeles, and Uruguay all in the same day, you can do that as well.
Well, wanted to talk about. Sorry, Brett, you wanted to talk about like economic issues. Just imagine how that would change the world's economy. And think about, I read somewhere that tourism and travel is one of the biggest industries in the entire world. Well, what if you didn't get on a plane and fly for 16 hours to get to Australia from the U.S.? Mm. What if you just sat down in your chair and went into an avatar that is in Sydney and you can experience taking a tour of the Sydney Harbor and then go home in an hour? I mean, just think of how that would change everything.
Yeah. Well, think about how this podcast is going, right? So we're all three in different locations. With avatar technology, we can not only be in three different locations, but if the three of us wanted to be building a birdhouse or a skyscraper and we had those talents, we could be doing that. So it's not just for a doctor. It could also be for a landscaper. It could be for a waiter. It could be because I want to see my mother. The point of it is it's instant travel, but also with a whole bunch of extras. I mean, I could put in a whole range of sensors in these things and other capabilities. So not only can I go anywhere, but I could be superhuman. It's kind of what Ray has been talking about a long time. He doesn't see machines and AI as something that will replace humans. Humans and AI and machines will find more and more ways to work together and enhance each other. In the same way that my cell phone right now is enhancing me, both from my memory and my ability to search for things, but also to be in this phone call.
Very cool. So what sort of timing have you got on this project? You talked about 18 months. So Amazon.
So the let's be so the book is already out. Avatar Dreams is out right now. Are you talking about the first commercial Avatars rolling out?
Yeah. What's your time? You talked about middle of next decade for that, but what's the timeline?
So the timeline is we will seek to show the commercial Avatars sometime in the summer of 2020. To commercially roll out in 2022. There's a long Q&A quality assurance process that'll take place. The one we display in 2020 will be a demo model, and then this next version for that will be the commercial model. So I'm predicting a 2022 as the earliest rollout date.
Very, very cool. Very cool. All right. Well, listen, I just want to take a quick break, guys. And then when we get back, I want to talk a bit more, delve a bit more into artificial intelligence and maybe, some of the discussion around Elon's goal, SpaceX becoming a multi-planetary species, getting into some real sci-fi stuff. Is that okay with you?
Sure.
Great. All right. So guys, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Brett King. I have two incredible guests right now. We're talking to Kevin J. Anderson, Harry Klor, Dr. Harry Klor, and we'll be right back after this break.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Now, before we get back to talking about fintech, I want to take a quick moment to tell you about efinancialcareers.com, one of the supporters of the show. They're the world's leading career site for financial service professionals for over 15 years. efinancialcareers.com partners with leading financial and fintech firms, so your resume is seen by all the top companies and recruiters in the US and abroad. Now, as we all know, financial services is a very dynamic, ever-changing industry, and eFinancial Careers provides valuable resources from helpful career coaching to interview strategies and tools that keep you up to speed and well-informed with what's happening now in the industry and what it means for your career. Registration's free for financial professionals. Make sure you take advantage of all the resources they have to offer. So check them out, efinancialcareers.com.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
And you're back with Breaking Banks. I am your host, Brett King. So we're continuing our discussion of how sci-fi influences sort of real-world technology development with two guys who should know about it because they've written plenty of sci-fi and they're involved in the translation of some of these sci-fi concepts to reality. We have with us Kevin J. Anderson and Harry Klor. So, guys, I will just ask you before we delve back into sort of deep technology stuff, what do you think about the fact that right now there's so much sci-fi in sort of contemporary space? You know, 40 years ago, it was really tough to get stuff on TV, for example, and now we've got, Altered Carbon and Black Mirror and, so much stuff happening. What does it feel like to be in an arena where, you don't have to fight for it anymore to get sci-fi in the popular space?
Well, that it feels like we're victorious. The nerds have actually won. When I was going through high school, of course, I had to sort of hide the fact that I was reading Edgar Rice Burroughs or Conan and stuff like that. And that was the thing that only the people, you had time to read science fiction because you were the sort that never got dates. And so
speak for yourself.
Well, Harry, you're an exception everywhere. I am speaking for myself. But you read it, and it was always something silly, but there was nothing on. I mean, Star Trek was it only lasted 3 years. I mean, in today's market, it would have been considered kind of a failure. And in fact, it was canceled after year two, but the fans had this big write-in campaign and got it extended to a third season, which they opened up with Spock's brain, but let's not get into that. The other thing, I mean, I remember watching Buck Rogers every week because it was terrible, but it was the only science fiction.
The only sci-fi that was out, yeah.
Yeah, and so you watched it
and
all,
then,
but...
And then Battlestar Galactic, the first gen of Battlestar Galactica as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we were, I mean, just think of Bill Gates, and we were all the nerds, and we've actually grown up, and now we're the tech innovators and the science fiction writers, and the we basically have taken over the world, and the big jock that used to give us wedgies is now working in the mailroom for us. So
yeah, and he's washing our truck. So, no, that's true. I remember racing home with my friends in high school so we could watch the repeats of Star Trek. And now, of course, we live in a world where we can instantly pull up Star Trek at any time, as well as any other sci-fi show through any number of means. And of course, we not only are we the guys who dream that technology up, but we fulfill the sci-fi and the science. And in fact, Kevin has been giving some good talks, and I've been giving talks through my life on how science influences science fiction and science fiction influences science, and they definitely have a relationship. And much of the things I've done have probably been initially inspired by science fiction, and led me to my science, and my science is interfaced through my life with my science fiction writing.
Now, Harry, this is where you differ a little from Kevin, because you're I don't know if you'd say you're classically trained as a scientist, but Kevin, you know, given you've written so much in the space, and you've written in genres which are more fantasy versus the science element of it, but how much work do you put into, you know, and this is always the Star Wars versus Star Trek universe argument, but how much work do you actually put into the hard science elements of things when you're writing?
Well, I mean, we didn't mention this, but my degree is in physics and astronomy. I mean, I came up with a scientific basis.
Oh, my apologies. Harry's double degree, a double PhD.
I am a scientific paramecium compared to Harry, but I have a scientific mindset. I know the scientific method, and everything. You don't just make things up. It all has to make sense. And in fact, when I got the gig to write the very first Star Wars novel that I did, everybody, I'm sure, knows this, and you cringe when you watch the original Star Wars movie when Harrison Ford, Han Solo, says, you know, is the Millennium Falcon fast? She did the Kessel Run in under 12 parsecs. And that's wrong, because a parsec is a distance. And that always bugged me. And so in the first chapter of my first Star Wars book, I retrofitted it, because I made up, okay, how is that going to work? How is that silly comet, how does it make sense? And so I made up what the Kessel Run was, in that it's a convoluted journey through a black hole cluster that you have to take these roundabout ways in order not to be sucked down into a gravity well. But if your ship is really fast, you can take a shortcut and do it in under 12 parsecs. And so that's like right there in the beginning. And I was kind of pleased to watch the new Solo movie where they did exactly that. They pretty much took my stuff and put it in the movie. So
Kevin is not only great in his science fiction, but he's helping to fix one of the biggest glaring errors. Unfortunately, they've continued to make even bigger and bigger errors. And
I wasn't going to get into the details, but when I met with George Lucas when I was starting to write those, I was all excited. I said, George, I fixed that mistake you made. And he just looked at me and said, well, in my universe, parsecs means speed or time. Okay. I still put it in there.
So let's get into AI. Obviously, there's a lot of debate right now around where artificial intelligence is going to take us. You know, we've got some components of AI, like natural language processing and so forth, that are making huge leaps and bounds. And for the first time, we really have machines that can observe and learn. But, you know, where do you guys fit on the spectrum of sort of the dystopia versus utopian view of where AI is going to fit in the world?
So I've gone on the record, and actually on C-SPAN, there's a funny little piece where I'm talking about avatars and point out that, you know, when the Terminator War comes, do you want to fight it in your meat suit or do you want to fight it in one of my avatars? And what that joke really means is look, we don't need to be afraid of AI. And the reason you don't, at least for the time being, is there has been a slight bill of goods sold to the public. There is no general AI. The AI that right. you see in dystopic movies and books is what would be called general AI. The AI that exists is specific AI. And what does that mean? It means that you have to train it. You have to either physically program it or train it through reinforced learning. It is not capable of taking on a general task, and there is no sort of work really being done on, here's an example of a general AI. And what that means is there's no thought process actually involved behind the scene. If I teach a child to wash a cup, it can then wash a spoon and a plate, and go send your kid out under child labor laws and have it wash your car. An AI can't do that. I have to teach it to wash every single cup, and I then can't hand it a spoon. That's the difference between specific AI. Now, if I had a general AI, I teach it to wash a cup, and it'd wash my cat, my dog, whatever I wanted washed.
Yeah, you can teach it to wash a car, but it doesn't mean it's going to be able to drive the car, right?
Well, your child won't be able to drive it either. But the point being is general AI doesn't exist, and we don't really have any examples of general AI, and specific AI does not evolve into general AI.
Well, and one of the things I'd like to add in, because as a science fiction writer, we get to make up ideas and throw them out there, but what we also excel in is make up what could possibly go wrong. And that's what our job is, to come up with ways it could be ruined. And you know that old gun control comment is that guns don't kill people, people kill people. Well, AIs, there's nothing bad about them, but people are bad, and somebody can do something to screw it up. And in fact, I was talking with Ray Kurzweil about ethics of AI, and he was working, I forget what the company was, he was working to develop ethical backgrounds for AIs to figure out.
The Google DeepMind project, the ethical
Just for like Google self-driving cars, and the example that he gave was really fascinating. He said, so you have a Google self-driving car, and the car has this ethical background to know that it's supposed to keep the passengers safe. It's supposed to not kill anybody, keep them safe. But what if you're in a situation where the AI is driving the car, and you've got two passengers in back, and then a woman with a baby stroller walks right out in front of the car, and the AI has to calculate, if I swerve, I'm going to kill the passengers, but if I keep going, I'm going to kill the woman with the baby. How do I decide? And that's something that you never thought about has to be programmed into a self-driving car. But the thing that concerns me, and the other thing that he was talking about is, so where do you base your ethics? I mean, we sort of have a Judeo-Christian ethical background that we use as deciding things. Well, what if the person designing the AI is from ISIS? I mean, they have a completely different ethical background. So all of that, it's the AI itself is wonderful technology, but look at all the computer viruses, the malicious things that come out. Some idiot, some disgruntled kid in a garage is going to come up with a way to bring down the financial network or something just because he's pissed off at his girlfriend.
Yeah, absolutely. So, when we talk about sort of bridging this gap, and obviously we're in this soft AI or machine learning specific AI stuff right now. But there are some efforts. We had Ben Goertzel on the program just before Christmas, and he was talking about SingularityNet and sort of this effort to create on the blockchain a way to get to AGI. But before we get to that, there's obviously going to be some disruption of the way we work. because of the fact that we're going to take repetitive tasks and automate them through robotic processes or simple AI. How do you think we're placed as a society to adapt to changing employment? There's a lot of discussion around the fact that we're going to create new jobs, but there's also, you know, commentators who will argue that it's like the start of the Industrial Revolution all over again, where there was a lot of displacement because a lot of those traditional skills became obsolete, almost overnight.
Well, I'll jump in real quick, which is, as you just mentioned, there's always been displacement. Go back 150 years and you'll see that most everyone worked in agriculture and now almost nobody works in agriculture. Will there be pain points? I'm sure there will be as innovation leaps forward. But I'm one of these people who don't think that, well, AIs are going to take over all of our tasks and we're going to have forever mass unemployment and we're going to need to give everyone a living wage for sitting on their butt. That I think will lead to the worst future. In my opinion, what will happen is one, if we work more efficiently and we all end up working a little less but making a lot more, that's great. I was just in Russia with Peter at this conference and this one guru, literally a guru, was speaking. And he says, we all work our entire lives so we can have those periods of vacation and periods of time where we're not working. And now everyone's complaining that technology is going to mean that we have to work very little. So I actually have a very optimistic, abundant view of the future, which is great. The more physical tasks AI can take on and robots can take on and other things can take on, that means we'll all lift. In addition, I believe that with every innovation, actually more opportunities are created. I can't tell you what they are, but 150 years ago, no one could describe to you programmers for the internet, building of computers, airplanes, all these other industries which now exist. You couldn't even imagine television. Pretty much everything that's in our lives 99.99% of the time didn't exist other than us eating and moving from place to place in a horse and carriage.
Kevin?
Well, my very first novel, it was 30 years ago this month it was published, called Resurrection Inc., where they kind of do a similar thing, where instead of building robots, they just jumpstart perfectly serviceable dead bodies and have them do all the grunt work. They pick the crops, they dig the ditches, they handle the toxic waste. They put like a processor in their head. And the person who invents this technology is all optimistic. And he says he's going to free humans of all the drudgery of all the hard work that they do. And it'll give us a chance to have more art and think of all the symphonies that'll be written and all the sculptures that'll be made. And people can aspire to things. And everybody just basically sits around and complains that they got too much time in their hands. They don't know what to do. And Harry's, I admire Harry's optimism, but there's also a whole segment of people that will just sit around and not do anything and complain about it.
Well, wait, they'll do something. They'll make more cat videos.
Well, that's the art I was talking about, Harry. It's the
English. So it turned out to be true, though. See, they're making art. It's just not art we appreciate. It's a good example, though. The book you just mentioned was before social networking and a way for especially our millennials and youth to waste enormous amounts of time. I think there is a great use, by the way, of social networking if you're someone like Kevin who's got all kinds of books out, but I personally try to avoid it as much as possible.
All right, so listen, I want to get to...
on my Facebook page.
Yeah, I do want to get to some of the projects you guys are working on before we finish up. But just before that, I thought I'd ask you one of those big picture questions, which is, you know, there's a lot of debate right now when we see Bezos and Musk and others talking about, getting us to Mars and putting bases on the moon and so forth. Where do you guys sit? I mean, I think I know the answer to this, given that you're both big sci-fi fans, but where do you sit on the need for us to become a multiplanetary species, and when do you think that's really going to happen?
I think it's going to happen in this coming decade. I think one of the things you find out is that once commercial enterprise gets involved in things, you move much more rapidly. And so I 100% am behind Elon. And in fact, my approach is to deploy avatars actually onto Mars that are controlled from orbit of Mars, by the way, not from Earth. So I think we will become a multi-planetary species. I think it's absolutely necessary, and I think it's our destiny.
Yeah, because we haven't worked out subspace communication yet, so latency is going to be an issue from Earth. But Kevin?
Well, that's why you do it from orbit around Mars, and there's no latency. Exactly.
Well, and I fully agree. I think that we need to go in, and what people don't quite put into perspective is things like SpaceX and what Richard Branson's doing, what Elon Musk are doing, because for when we grew up, when Harry and I grew up, it was NASA with the big Apollo program. And you could only be the US or the Soviet Union that could afford such a gigantic project to launch a spacecraft. And now it's almost homegrown stuff that you can do, and it'll get better and better. And I just think it's obvious that we need to go out there. Is it the Turner hypothesis or something where you have to go to the edge of your boundaries because that's what human beings do? There'll be people who will just sit at home and complain because they don't have anything to do. But there are others who want to climb Mount Everest, who want to get into orbit, who want to be the first people on Mars. And there'll be pioneers, and that's where they're going to go. And that's where our human destiny goes. And I think we're smart enough to do it.
Absolutely. That's fantastic. All right. So I know you guys have a new book that you've collaborated on. We talked about it at the top of the show, which is Avatar Dreams, Science Fiction, Visions of Avatar Technology. So tell us about the book specifically, and we can get it on Amazon. Where else can we get a copy of it?
Well, wherever fine books are sold. I mean, basically, one thing we didn't mention is I'm also the publisher of WordFire Press. It's a small publishing company, but we've done over 300 books and we have 95 authors. So I guess it's not that small. But it uses new technology. Uses new technology to do ebooks and print on demand trade paper.
Similar to Kindle Direct.
Yes, right to Kindle and Nook and Kobo and whatever e-reader that you have. So it's just look it up, Avatar Dreams. And as we talked earlier, it's 14 stories by science fiction writers, just imagining what you could do with avatar technology. I'm publishing a whole bunch of books. I've got literally a book out every month until January. I'm releasing a 4-volume collection of all of my short stories. Just 2 days ago, I had a hardcover graphic novel out called Clockwork Lives. It's sort of a steampunk fantasy adventure that I wrote with Neil Peart, the drummer from Rush. Last month, I had an alternate history fantasy called Uncharted, what's called Lewis and Clark in Arcane America. So it's American history where magic works, and Lewis and Clark are exploring where there are dinosaurs and shapeshifters and stuff. So I don't stick with any one genre. I just tell whatever cool stories I can think of.
How do you cope with dealing with sort of multiple plot lines and multiple storylines simultaneously? Because you don't just write them sequentially, right? You must be writing all the time on different titles.
It's fragmented personality disorder, I think. It's probably the explanation for it. Well, I mean, it's like walking and chewing gum at the same time. I can multi-process when I'm writing the zombie PI stories. It's a one mindset. I'm in the middle of writing a giant epic fantasy right now with swords and monsters and quests and everything. So that's a different mindset. It's just, that's what I work. That's how I do everything.
Yeah. So, Harry, what projects are you working on for the remainder of the year that are interesting?
So my biggest project is this Beyond Imagination's name of the company. You can go to beyondimaginationco.com and join the Avatar Revolution. My mission now is to bring robotic avatars to life, to solve everything, to solve the sustainable development goals, to bring employment and opportunities for learning and helping everywhere on the planet. So that's my key focus, is getting that done. And then I do have a variety of science fiction projects underway, working with Tim Kring on a couple things, working with Kevin on a couple of things. And
I met Tim in LA a couple of years ago. He's an interesting guy.
Yeah, no, Tim's fantastic. So I'm working with Tim and Chris Bull and Raven on a big project. We're not ready to announce it yet, but that's fun. We just started that. And again, though, my primary focus, that you know, trying to change the way in which we live, in essence, erase locality. So it no longer will restrict you where you're born or where you live for where you work or play or learn. Will be a giant change in the world, and I think will bring out another golden age.
I'm all for that. I will ask you guys, before we close out the show, once you can remote operate or remote telepresence an avatar with all that biofeedback that you talk about, so that you feel like you're actually in that location while using it, we're only one step away from actually downloading our consciousness into a remote or a robot, which obviously the transhumanist community has been working on this or talking about this for a long time. Do you think that's the way humans will reach immortality? Will we go that path, or do you think it'll be biological enhancement or a bit of both?
So from my point, it will be a bit of both. And to be clear, that's not what we're doing right now. I want to do something that can be achieved right now. But right. Look, some point down the road, I do think we'll be able to download ourselves. I don't know if it'll be our entire selves, but we write books in part to preserve our knowledge in ourselves. The experiences you capture in my avatars will preserve your life to some extent. You'll be able to relive any experience you had in it, and others will be able to do that. And at some point, we will be able to download our memories and our personality. Who knows what level of consciousness we can download. And that will give us a form of immortality, especially because we can back ourselves up. And of course, eventually there will be 1,000 Kevin Andersons running around. So I'm not sure what that universe is going to look like.
Just imagine how many books I could do then. Well, I was going to go there, because what the interesting thing is everybody thinks of, if you back yourself up or if you can copy your consciousness and store it so that you're immortal, so that when your physical body dies, you're still around. It's almost comparable to ebooks. It's no longer a physical copy of a book. It's an ebook, which means you can copy it and 25 people can have the same book. Well, what if you're immortal and now there are 50 of you running around? Who is the real one, and who gets the credit for things, and who are the were the rights that person or copy of a person has? And see, that's my science fiction mind going, skipping from the first idea of you can back somebody up and make them immortal. And as an author, then we jump ahead and go, yeah, but what happens when 10 years later, this is the problem that you face? And who inherits the stuff when the original body dies, if there are 70 copies of Harry Clore around? That makes for interesting stories, because the geniuses who make up how to back up your consciousness aren't necessarily thinking of the social and ethical stuff. They're thinking about it technologically, do this thing. So, which means that it might take 300 Kevin Andersons just to explore all those different ideas.
I think it will take 300 Kevin Andersons.
I'm very interested right now in the sort of quantum consciousness theory. I was listening to Michio Kaku talk about this recently, and we've obviously still got a lot of work to do to really understand how consciousness works before we get to the point of downloading consciousness. But it's long been a goal of science fiction, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. I think, it's been a long time goal of humanity to reach immortality, right? So this is just one manifestation of that. There's a lot of other ways, right, one could could try to reach immortality? What if you could just, what if teleporters existed? You don't necessarily have to get rid of the original. You could just start duplicating yourself that way as well. So the question is, for instance, if I could make a molecular teleporter and I broke you down maybe to your entire quantum wave, then I start duplicating exact copies to you to the most, you know, minutest level, way beyond your particulate level to the very essence of your quantum wave, then is there an original? Because theoretically, under quantum physics, there is no original there.
Yeah. Hey, listen, Kevin, just as we finish up, I thought, given this week we've had the passing of Harlan Ellison, you know, you worked with him and collaborated with him, and maybe you can just tell us a few words about what he was like and what it was like to be in his presence and what you remember best about him.
In fact, since I learned yesterday at about lunchtime that he had passed away, I've been posting Harlan Ellison stories on my social media, and you finish one and then it just comes up with another one and then another one. And I'm starting to realize just how much of an impact he had on me. The Harlan Ellison was a legendary ogre. I mean, he had more lawsuits against people and he blew up at people. But the key to Harlan was, he didn't suffer fools. And if you said something stupid, he would make sure to let you know that it was stupid. And I fortunately, apparently, didn't say anything stupid in front of him. And so we were good friends and he respected me. But just, I'll be quick. One of the very first times that I had encountered Harlan is he called me up out of the blue. The phone rings in the middle of the afternoon and says, "This is Harlan Ellison." And I was just a new writer with a handful of stories published. Mm-hmm. I think maybe one novel published. And Harlan's calling me in the middle of the afternoon. I don't even know how he got my phone number. And we had a book called The Ultimate Werewolf had just come out with like 20 werewolf stories in it. And Harlan had a story in it. I had a story in it and a bunch of other authors. And Harlan calls me up and says, "Kev, did you read the article, the review in the LA Times about The Ultimate Werewolf?" No, I hadn't read it. I'm like speechless. Harlan Ellison is calling me. And he said, "Yeah, the reviewer pretty much hated the whole book and said the only two good stories in the entire book were the ones by Harlan Ellison and Kevin Anderson, and mine was the best." And I went, "Great, Harlan, ours were the only two good stories." And he said, "Yeah, but mine was the best. Mine was the best." And I stopped and I said, "Yeah, but Harlan, I'm taller than you are." And he just, he was fairly short. And he just like stopped. And I'm realizing I shouldn't have said that. He sues everybody. And then I said, "Yeah, but you've got better hair than I do." And then he went on and on about how great his hair was. But that was my first encounter, Harlan. Mm-hmm. Oh, and it turned out that I asked him to read me the review. And he said, "Well, I'm in a room in the house that doesn't usually have a phone in it, except mine does. And Harlan was sitting on the toilet calling me up to blow up the review."
That's awesome.
And so that was like the first time. But we get so many things. And one of my stories, in fact, I just released it 2 weeks ago as a separate ebook called Prisoner of War. It's a sequel to his Outer Limits episode, Soldier. And I had an Outer Limits project I was working on, and I wanted to do a sequel to Harlan's Soldier. It's a futuristic war with like soldiers bred and raised for war. And I wanted to do a sequel to it. And the publisher was terrified. "You can't do anything with Harlan Ellison's. He controls it. We don't want to do this." And I went, "Well, I'm just going to ask him."
I'll give him a call.
I called up Harlan and I said, "Harlan, I want to do a sequel to Soldier." And I explained the project. And he said, "No, sequels are useless. I said everything I wanted to say in the first thing and it's done. And I don't want anybody to do sequels of anything."
Ooh.
And I stopped and I said, "Harlan, are you telling me that in this entire future world you created with all these characters and all this culture and the history that's there, everything that's in your universe that you created, are you telling me that there's only one story that can be told in that entire universe?" And he stopped and went, "Well, I guess not. Okay, do the sequel, but make sure it's good." So I'm the only person I know of who has ever written a sequel to anything Harlan Ellison wrote.
Wow. Well, that's a great
congratulations.
And that's called Prisoner of War, and I just released it, so you can check that out.
Check it out. It's available wherever good books are sold. So, Kevin and Harry, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for joining us on the podcast today.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having us.
Lots of fun.
And that's it for another Breaking Banks this week. My thanks to Kevin J. Anderson and Dr. Harry Kula for joining us on the show this week and giving us some real glimpse into the mind of sci-fi authors in terms of some of these technologies that we're thinking about emerging over the next 10, 20 years. They're going to change the way we live and work. My thanks also to Westpac New Zealand, who helped sponsor the show this week. Westpac.co.nz, you can go there and check them out. They've been hosting me down in Auckland today, where I'm pre-recording this show for you. I'm about to get it back on a flight via Los Angeles back home to New York, where of course next week we will be there for another Breaking Bank show for you guys. That brings us to the fine point of what we need from you guys. It was really helpful as if you can go to iTunes or Google Play or Podcaster or Stitcher or wherever it is that you download your Breaking Banks from. If you listen to it live stream, give us a 5-star review, give us a shout out, tell us what you think about the show, give us some ideas for some other shows you'd like. That's all super helpful for us for getting the news out about the episode. If you like this week's episode, if you like the guest, then share the episode. Get other people to listen to it. That's really helpful for us and helps us get the word out there. We really appreciate that. But that's a wrap for this week's show. Also, check out Provoke.fm, check out Serial Entrepreneur, check out FinTech 5, the other podcasts we run on through the Provoke.fm network. And as always, stay healthy, stay happy, and we will see you on Breaking Banks again next week.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.